From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across America, middle-income families in the 1990s stood by and watched the success stories of the economic boom with noses planted firmly on the grindstone. At $42,000, the country's median household income has grown, but debt has piled up even faster. Paying mortgages and rent, babysitters, and grocery bills has many families tiptoeing a narrow fence between tight budgeting and crushing debt. There's little cushion available if an unexpected emergency knocks a family off the beam. This week, the Wall Street Journal is running a series profiling families who fall in the median household income range. The series, Stuck in the Middle, focuses on five working families living at the median, well outside the government or media spotlight. Without the glamour of wealth or the life and death drama of poverty, many middle-income families perform a daily juggling act of income and expenses with an agility that would startle an MBA. But it's not easy. With jobs getting scarcer and money getting tighter, how do families make it in the middle of the American economy? How far does $42,000 go in your family? If that's the household median, is that what you mean by middle class? Do you have the grit, the juggling skills to make it at the American median? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is Elizabeth Weinstein, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who came up with the idea for this series. Good evening and welcome, Elizabeth Weinstein.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. And it's been really illuminating to read the stories that you've had running all this week from all across the country, people making right around that $40,000, $45,000 mark that entails the American median. But I wanted to ask you, Elizabeth, it's been a season of stories about mega zillionaires. What led you at the Wall Street Journal to focus on families living at the median?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, we see so many headlines in the papers these days about corrupt executives, people who are making gross amounts of money that a huge portion of us can't really identify with or imagine. And so we really wanted to take a look at a segment of the population that doesn't really get that much upfront attention and don't grab the headlines. And there's a huge swath of different kinds of households between the coasts, and we wanted to put a face on those numbers.
And when your readers, many of them businessmen and women, read this, what are they thinking? This is a target market or it's not a target market?
Well, hopefully they're thinking, wow, I can really identify with this, you know, because I'm from, even though maybe I'm an executive now, I'm from a household like this. I grew up in a middle class neighborhood. I can identify with this. It's either A, it brings me back, or B, it's something that we need to know about right now because, again, you know, there's a huge portion of the population that are living in the middle, and Hopefully it's something they can identify with.
How did you go out, Elizabeth Weinstein, and choose the families that you've chosen to profile?
Well, that's a good question. It's kind of baffling to be faced with finding a family in the South. That was my region that I picked. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to cover cities of different sizes. I chose Louisville. It's got a population. The city population is right around 250,000. Surrounding areas about 1 million. And I made calls. I went to community centers. I talked to church groups, recommendations, people who know people, and chambers of commerce. And finally, I found a good contact at the Louisville Urban League who knew a good family.
And a very interesting story it is. You also have families from Iowa, from Portland, Oregon, and tomorrow from
New Bedford, Massachusetts.
When you look out at what you heard back from these families about how they were making ends meet, what did you find most striking?
A lot of them, it surprised me that a lot of them didn't have much saved for retirement. That was one thing. In some cases, their employers didn't offer retirement plans, but in others, there were immediate concerns that overruled any chance to save for retirement. One of the big concerns was health care, and my family really exemplified that. But there were two of the households we profiled had children that required special care early on, and mm-hmm. so the families had major expenses early on, and saving for retirement is kind of secondary after that. But all of them saw retirement planning is essential. And also, as you mentioned in your introduction, the people in our households were generally happy with their lives and felt relatively unaffected immediately affected by the economic downswing, but they also felt like they were living on the edge, so to speak. And mm-hmm. a layoff, an unexpected health need, or any unanticipated expense could put them in a bad situation. And they all also, our profiles show how they all pinch pennies in ways that a lot of us don't think about. My family, Erica, she saves at the grocery store and buys at discounters. One of our couples has bought everything secondhand, and mm-hmm. and there are a lot of little ways that they save money each day, and it requires attention that and detail that a lot of people don't think about when they're out shopping.
There's a real discipline to it. What was your sense, Elizabeth Weinstein, of how the lives of Americans at the median right here compares with our kind of media impression of what American life is today?
Well, it's kind of funny. A lot of our families lived in small, nice tree-lined neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. That's something that we found with our families. They do live in tree-lined neighborhoods, and a lot of them, owned houses, and their children felt safe playing outdoors. Yeah. That was one of the biggest, but they, I'd say that was the biggest.
Mm-hmm. I guess part of the reason we're attracted to this may be the same reason that you were, that there's been so much attention to the millionaires of the 90s, whatever their status now. And when you look in American magazines and media, you see so much attention on the high life, the super affluent life, that somehow the median, where there's half below and half above, tends to get lost.
Absolutely. And there are people, we hear so much about the plight of the poor, and these days it's especially just, there are so many examples of the grossly wealthy, but there are people out there, and it's in the majority of America, and they're budgeting, they're scrimping, they're saving, and they're really working to get by.
We're going to talk tonight about how people are doing that, how they make ends meet, how it feels to live right at that median in America. We've been talking with Elizabeth Weinstein, Wall Street Journal reporter. I want to welcome into our conversation now Jared Bernstein. He's senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute and author of the forthcoming book, The State of Working America. Good evening and welcome, Jared Bernstein.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Jared Bernstein, help us, if you would, first understand what the median income is and the different kind of terminology here. There's household income, then there's family household income.
Sure.
How do we define household income today, and what's the difference between that and family household income?
Well, let me start with the second half of the question. The difference between household income and family income is that households, and this is all census terminology, mm-hmm. include individuals. Families in census world are two or more people related by blood, adoption, or marriage. So household income, which, as you mentioned earlier, is about 42,000 at the median right now, mm-hmm. is considerably lower than family median income, which is closer to 50,000, because the household tally includes all these individuals. Since they live by themselves, they typically have less earning power and, on average, lower income.
But the Census Bureau refers to them as a household unit, even if it's a unit of one.
Exactly.
Now, there's a lot of variation in these. We've seen that the household median in the South was about 38,400, Midwest 44,000, West 44,700, Northeast 45,000, and
right.
and in individual city areas, Boston 46,900. Spokane, Washington, 42,000, Dallas, 39,800, Erie, 43,700, Buffalo, 41,600. Are they close enough that you can usefully look at national numbers, or is it all about focusing in regionally?
I think it depends on the question you're asking. I thought one of the aspects of the journal's articles that were interesting was that they showed you how far what sounds like a pretty low income in, say, Boston or New York mm-hmm. goes in, one of the articles was about a relatively small town in Iowa. And that's why all those numbers you were just citing have to be taken with a grain of salt, because while incomes are higher on the coast, they're higher in the Northeast, they're higher in some of the large cities in the West, and lower in the South, prices are also lower in those areas with lower incomes. So if we were able to adjust for local price differences, you wouldn't see quite the variance that you're finding. Nevertheless, there is quite a bit of variance around the country, and it's certainly the case that folks in areas with higher median incomes do have more buying power than those in areas with lower income.
We're going to talk later in the hour with that family in DeWitt, Iowa, that's doing just fine on, what was it, Elizabeth Weinstein, a $38,000 or something like
that? Yeah, they're hovering right around the Midwest, 40 in the low 40s, 40 around 42, I think.
We'll talk to them later at $42,000. He's president of the local Chamber of Commerce. But I wanted to ask you, Jared Bernstein, just at the most general top level, how is the median income household doing in America today? What's your assessment?
Well, I think the median household income is doing much the way you and Elizabeth have been discussing. The median household has enough income to get by in a way that many of these families identify as, if not comfortable, at least the wolf's not at the door. Mm-hmm. There may be a little bit left for savings. They're typically able to meet the demands on that income, demands for your basic consumption goods such as rent and child care and transportation. These families are significantly taxed when a health problem, an unforeseen health problem surfaces. And I think that's a big problem that the articles identify. It's actually a national policy problem that I hope we have some time to discuss. But I do think the articles capture the spirit of today's median family. These are families who are by no means impoverished. They are typically out of reach of government safety net programs, but they don't necessarily need those programs. They do face constraints when they have, for example, a catastrophic health problem. They also are and I don't think this probably came out as much in the articles I've read so far, they're working much more now than they ever have been.
Meaning more hours per week?
Exactly. They're spending more hours per week in the paid labor market. If you look at national statistics, you will find that the typical middle-income family is working about 12 weeks more per year than they were 20 years ago. This is mostly...
That's a lot.
Yeah, and it's almost exclusively the increase in work by wives. We know that over this period, women have entered the labor force. They're working more weeks per year and more hours per week. That's
a big change. Jared Bernstein, I want to ask you just about the shape of our economy. We're talking about the median. Of course, that means that half of households make more than this median, half would make less. We hear about the hourglass shape of the American economy. That would suggest a lot of people at the top incomes and a lot of people at the lower, closer to poverty incomes. But is that true? Is there a bulge in the middle? Is this where most Americans are or not?
It's where most Americans are. As you said earlier in your conversation, I think Elizabeth said, you know, that's where most families are, and that's why, in some sense, at least from the media's perspective, this silent majority or perhaps unexamined majority is particularly interesting.
But it's not really an hourglass,
then. It's not really an hourglass. I think the hourglass story comes from the following observation. The share of families that inhabit the middle has fallen over time. If you look at the percent of American, let's talk about households to keep this clear. Mm-hmm. If you look at the percent of American households earning between, say, $25,000 and $75,000, you know, roughly a middle class, although we could argue about exactly how to define that, you'll find that that share has fallen from about 55% to about 46%, something like that, about a 10 percentage point, 9-10 percentage point drop.
But it's still a very substantial part of the population.
Exactly. It's still a large chunk of the population, close to half, and it's gone from a little bit more than half to a little bit less than half.
Is life at the median income still what you would describe, what most Americans think of as middle class?
Well, you know, we could probably spend hours debating what those two words mean. I happen to think that since the median, as you've said, is right smack in the middle of the income scale, it certainly makes sense to consider that middle class. And I think most median income families would consider themselves middle class, and we would probably agree that that's a fair assessment. The challenge comes when you talk about families at the lower or higher end of the income scale. You can find a family in New York City with income of $100,000 a year that looks and sounds pretty middle class. if you put that family in DeWitt, Iowa, I suspect they'll be pretty wealthy.
We're going to look more closely at how American families are getting by or making do at the American median, the household income median. How far does $42,000 go in your household? Are you living at the American median? How's it working? Do you feel secure? Have you left $42,000 far behind? And can you imagine going back? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
I'm Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about life in the middle tonight, living at the American median income. And the question is, how far does, would $42,000 go in your household? Are you living at the American median? How's it going? Do you feel secure? Or have you left $42,000 far behind? Can you imagine going back and living at the median? Or is $42,000 still something you aspire to? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and Elizabeth Weinstein, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, who kicked off a series of stories in the journal this week on families living at the median. We're delighted to be joined right now by the head of one of those households, Erica McMurray, joining us from Louisville, Kentucky, who was profiled this week in the Wall Street Journal. Erica McMurray, good evening, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We now know a lot more about you than you know about us, having read about you in the Wall Street Journal, along with probably a million other people.
Yes.
It must feel funny to be under such a microscope.
It is. It's overwhelming to have so much recognition, and people walk up to me and say, you know, I read about you, or I seen you in the paper, and I never knew that you was going through that, or, you know, that you were living on such an income.
Well, it's really what we want to ask you about. And as in the tone of the Wall Street Journal stories, we have enormous respect for the way you put this household together, and having read through the details, are really impressed at what it takes to juggle. But tell us about your basic financial situation. We know from the journal that your income has been about $35,700 a year, slightly below the South's median household income of $38,000. You've got three children. There's some health problems in the family. What does it take to get your family through a month?
Patience and endurance, you know, just making sure that, you know, the major bills are paid and working with what I have and just making sure everything important is taken care of and just hoping that something extra will come through to take care of, the, you know, everything else. But just, you know, I just keep going. I don't think about, oh, I don't have enough. As long as the major things are paid, then I work with whatever's left.
And share with us your thinking about spending. How do you decide when you're prepared to spend on something in particular? What kinds of things are off limits to you? How disciplined do you have to be with your household budget to make it work?
I have to be very disciplined. You know, a while ago I had a splurge where I would just go spend and not take into consideration of how much I was spending and so forth, and then I would be, you know, in a hole. And I've learned better. And when I go out, I'll see something, and I might pick it up, but before I get to the cash register, I'm like, no, I don't need that because something might happen. My car may need to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The air conditioner may break down, you know. I might get sick and have to pay for a doctor's visit that is unexpected. So, you know, I just make sure that I just don't do it anymore because it's not needed.
We read, if I recall correctly, that you've thrown your credit cards away.
Oh, yeah. I had to get rid of them because I thought I could use them and use them for an emergency, but when it came down to the emergency, I realized that I used them and I really didn't have the money to pay for what I used for emergency.
Mm-hmm. And we understand that, but I guess that leaves me wondering, how much of an unexpected expense does it take in your household to throw everything topsy-turvy? If there's an extra $200 expense you didn't anticipate, is that a big problem, or is it $400? What's it take to kind of tip you totally out of whack in any given month?
It could be $60 because I receive SSI for my daughter, and if I get an extra paycheck or, you know, overtime on my paycheck,
mm-hmm.
the next month they will cut like $400, and that is unexpected. So, you know, that's when I came into play with using my credit cards, and then I was like, well, you know, next month I still won't get that amount, so I'm still left without.
And what about health care? Your daughter has a chromosome abnormality that has brought extra expenses into your life. You've had your own health issues. How big and bad a wolf is that in your budget planning?
It's my daughter's isn't that bad because the state covers her. I don't have her on my insurance. If I did, then I really wouldn't be able to afford it because my insurance wouldn't cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I have her on the state, and as far as my health, you know, I have lupus, and every so often I'll have a flare-up, and it would get so bad to where the medication I have isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an unexpected doctor's visit, and then he increases my medication with new prescriptions, and some of them are partially covered or not covered by the insurance. So, you know, that's a big chunk out of my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it varies depending on how well I'm doing and how well I keep myself healthy and so forth.
Erica McMurray, we appreciate so much your sharing this with us. Tell us just about, you make 35.7. It's almost at the median for the southern median household income. You have a family of four. Do you feel middle class?
Yes, I do. I feel middle class because I feel that I'm making it. You know, I have a house. Me and my children are well fed. Even though I have health issues and my daughter does, we're healthy. We're still going. And, you know, we just keep going. And no one will ever know that I'm, you know, at that level of income. We just keep ourselves going, and we just have such appearance that everything is okay.
Do you feel like the American economy is working for you, Erica?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. You know, with my daughter, I feel like there's more that I could be getting for her and assistance that I can receive as far as therapy and so forth, but I just don't know where to turn for that. But as far as me and my kids, you know, we're fine. You know, the economy is working fine for us. My kids are in a good school. You know, I have a good job, and there's no one holding me down or holding my kids down or pushing them back and saying they're not good enough.
We can hear your determination and your discipline, and it's terrific. What did you think of the journal's write-up? Did they capture your situation pretty accurately?
Oh, yes. It was. She had it worded so beautiful, and that was me. And when I read it, I was just like, wow, at the end, because I was just so amazed that she had captured me and my family so perfectly, that she put down everything that I said and just had it like I was just speaking from the column, and she was speaking from the column herself. It was wonderful.
Elizabeth, it sounds like you caught this pretty well. Any thoughts post-publication on Erica McMurray's family or that come to mind as you listen to her this evening?
Oh, gosh, I appreciate it. Erica, you're sweet. Erica, she really is. You know, we spent a day in Louisville together. The whole day we drove around. We went shopping together. We had lunch, and her children are really special. She's you know, definitely making it work, and she's a hard worker, and she's got a lot to work for because she's got three great kids who need her. So she's a good example of somebody who's making it in the middle, and she's also a pretty inspiring person. So,
but it's not easy. The family doesn't go to movies. They wait for the video you write. All the clothes shopping is at Walmart or Fashion Shop.
Yes,
fine, but not fancy.
No.
And when you go out to eat, and I guess it's not often, it's at an all-you-can-eat buffet, and why not? Why not? Because you can fill the plate.
Oh, yeah. Well, the kids love it. It gives us such a freedom to be able to go up to the bar and pick what they want and just have their own choice instead of sitting at a table and getting the menu and they limit it to a certain thing. I mean, my son's 9 years old, and he's of the age now where he says he doesn't want the kiddie platter. He wants the grown-up platter.
Make it a big one.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the best to all your family and to you. And Erica McMurray, thank you for sharing with us this evening. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jared Bernstein, when you listen to this story from Louisville, Kentucky, does this sound like a typical picture of an American family at the median?
Yeah, it actually does. I mean, first of all, it's pretty inspiring, and I think probably one of the reasons it doesn't sound maybe all that typical to most people is because we just don't hear it very much, as you and Elizabeth have stressed.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you one thing that interests me in the story and listening to Erica speak. When you asked her about how the economy was doing, she definitely hesitated and, you know, tried to assess what that meant for her. And I interpreted her answer as it's working pretty well from her perspective. She makes a middle-income salary, but she has this difficult health situation with her daughter,
mm-hmm.
not to mention herself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the article said that her kid gets Medicaid, and she mentioned SSI.
Right.
Now, these are both federal programs that provide very extensive coverage, but they're typically targeted, or at least historically, they've been targeted at poor families. If you had income of 35,000 or plus, historically, you wouldn't have been able to get Medicaid or SSI for your children.
Hmm.
The fact is that in the last few years, Congress introduced a program called CHIP, the Child Health Insurance Program, and that program made Medicaid eligible to families whose incomes were as high as Erica's, twice the poverty line, or closing in on the median.
And sounds like that's pretty important to her in her case.
It sounds like it's not only pretty important, it sounds like it's the difference between making it and not making it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a message that we need to really absorb from the story.
We're talking tonight about life in the middle, about living at the American median income. If $42,000 is the median income, do you consider $42,000 a middle-class income? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Amy's on the line. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
It doesn't feel like it's middle income, like we're middle-class people. I look around me. I live in Marshfield, which is a somewhat well-to-do town.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And people live in much bigger houses than we do. They drive much nicer cars than we do. And I'm looking to cut corners everywhere I can.
Do you find yourself in this conversation saying, yes, I'm falling somewhere in that median range?
Yes, we're falling in that median range, but our lifestyle is not what I consider to be middle class. There are no vacations. There are no nights out. I get my hair cut once a year. I shop in a consignment shop. Right now we're contemplating getting rid of the family dog because it's just one more expense that I'm not sure we can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a stay-at-home mother,
mm-hmm.
and it appears as though I'm going to have to go back to work now.
Have you done the math on that, Amy, when you factor in child care?
Does it today.
Do you come out ahead working or not?
I would need to find a job making $57,000 a year just to clear $300 a week because child care would be $600 a week.
Mm.
For three children.
Jared Bernstein, Amy, we hear you loud and clear, and stick with us. Jared Bernstein, this child care issue must be a huge kind of tipping point for families at the median.
Exactly. I mean, we've studied this issue at the Economic Policy Institute and find that for low-income families, child care can easily absorb a fifth of their income. And I think the calculation that you and Amy were just discussing is exactly the point. You know, we talked about how the provision of health care made such a difference in Erica's family. I hope that someday in this country we're willing to embrace policy that helps people afford child care. We actually have policies that help subsidize child care for low-income families, but we really don't do anything for those in the middle. So I think Amy raises an important point.
But Amy, you're saying that you may make the median household income, but you don't feel what seems to you middle class.
No, not at all. I look at my friends, and they've all taken summer vacations. They are all driving nice cars. I'm driving a 10-year-old van that's on its last legs, and I don't have the money to buy another car after that.
Amy, we wish you the best. Thanks for calling in tonight. It's good to have you. Sandra's on the line. Welcome, Sandra. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two points I wanted to make, and Amy really hit one of them home.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it seems like, first of all, I work in housing research, and so I see firsthand and up close how housing is a major, major component of expenses today.
Sure.
My overall comment was that today, more than a decade ago and compared to a generation ago, the middle really isn't the middle. I mean, the middle is the middle, but it's not what it used to be. The median income doesn't buy what it used to be, doesn't buy today what it used to buy in terms of standard of living. And there are two major expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Amy just touched on
the child care,
and that's because you have to have two parents working if you're a two-parent household. If you're a single parent, you're stuck like Amy, and you have to make this trade-off. The other expense, as I alluded to, is housing. And in tight markets, like Boston, for example,
mm-hmm.
you have to fork out $2,000 a month for a very modest apartment. And this is not, you know...
That's a lot of money.
That's not a particularly super neighborhood either. So,
mm-hmm. Sandra, stand by. I want to put your impression to Jared. Jared Bernstein,
yeah.
How about it? Here's the impression. The middle ain't what it used to be. Is that statistically true?
Well, I would say in the sense that what's the caller's name? Is it?
This is Sandra.
In the sense that Sandra is telling us, I agree with her. I mean, the middle is of course the middle. The median is always 50% above, 50% below.
But does it buy the quality of life that the median income bought 10 years, 20 years?
That's what I was going to say. In terms of child care, health care, housing, and education, Sandra's absolutely right. And those are obviously crucial expenses that have a great deal of impact on how we experience our living standards. They're all relatively more expensive than they used to be. On the other hand, there are other goods, such as electronics, televisions, cars to some extent. Many of these goods are tremendously cheaper than they used to be, communications. So I want to just flesh out the picture and say that there are goods that are relatively cheaper than they used to be, and some of those goods are quite important to us. I mean, you can buy a great VCR for $50 these days. They used to cost $200. On the other hand, housing, childcare, healthcare, education, these are obviously crucial components of a decent middle-class living standard, and Sandra very clearly expresses, I think, the frustrations that many middle-income families experience given the expense of those items today relative to earlier periods.
Mm. Sandra, thanks very much for your call. Elizabeth Weinstein, in your reporting for this series, did you hear Americans at the median saying, I may be the middle, but I don't feel as middle or as well off as my parents or as well off as I expected to be at the middle?
No, actually, I didn't. Most of them, I got the impression that they were okay. They felt okay. They grew up in a lot of them grew up in comfortable households, or we have immigrants whose parents struggled, and they felt and the immigrants especially felt that they're doing as well, if not better than their parents.
Let's get one more call before the break. Russ is on the line. Hi, Russ. You're on the air. Hello, Russ. Are you there? My dear caller, Russ. Sounds like he's walking the dog. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. So you heard people saying, well, they're doing all right. But I wonder, what are the things, Jared Bernstein, that families at the median don't do that are kind of understood as part of the American economic life? Are they able to save for college? Are they able to save for retirement? What else is or is not there?
Well, I'll tell you, conversely, one of the things they do is they take on a lot more debt to do the things they used to do without so much debt. I think we heard some of that from earlier callers.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the debt related to college education has increased considerably, even over the boom of the latter 90s. Debt related to some basic consumption needs, even housing debt, has increased. We have a lot more home ownership, which is a great thing, but we also have considerably more debt, and that has something to do with how fast housing prices have risen in certain parts of the country. But, you know, it's pretty hard to say, and I think Elizabeth would probably agree, you know, what families are doing now relative to what they used to do, because we just don't, you know, have great records of that kind of behavior. I mean, we know families, you know, continue to, and this came out in the article, they make lots of long-distance calls, mm-hmm. they go to the movies, mm-hmm. you know, middle-income families.
Some do and some don't in the movies, depending
right.
on where they live and what movies cost.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think that the articles and our discussion capture well the point that middle-income families do experience constraints on their ability to consume. They're not the same as rich families who don't really probably think twice about going to the movie or ordering a pizza. On the other hand, they're not poor families who are unable to afford even some of their basic needs.
Listeners, we're talking about life in the middle tonight. Do you have the grit, the juggling skills to live at the American median income? What does being middle class mean today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life in the middle of the American economy, living at the American median income. Our guests are Jared Bernstein. He's senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute and author of the forthcoming book, The State of Working America. And Elizabeth Weinstein, she's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, who was part of the team that put together a series this week profiling American families living at the American median, whether in your particular region it's $40,000 or $42,000 or a family household income of $50,000. It's right at the center, where half of American families make more and half make less. We are joined now by another of the families that was profiled in the Wall Street Journal this week in DeWitt, Iowa. On the line with us, I hope and think, is Marty Morrell. Good evening, Marty.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We read with great interest about your life in DeWitt, Iowa, and what living at the median lives to you. In your case, it sounded like a life that really wasn't so much a life of painful pinching of pennies. You're described as having a 1,700-foot, three-bedroom home that cost $59,000, of going to matinee movies that cost $2, and a sandwich and fries at the local restaurant that's $3.95, car insurance running about $100 a month. It sounds as though the median income in your area, and I guess your household income is about, what was it, 41,000?
It was 41,000. That was a taxable income for
right?
last year.
And it sounds as though it lines up pretty well with the cost of living in your neighborhood.
Yeah, to a point, I agree with all of that. I think that's fairly accurate. I think one thing to understand, though, that our home was built in 1850, and we've done a lot of work to it, and that was one of the reasons we got into this house. It's what we wanted, and we were very fortunate with that.
But there's a lot of sweat equity in there.
There's a lot of sweat equity in this residence, and in this particular area, there is actually somewhat of a shortage of what you – depends on how you define affordable housing. I would define it as houses for first-time home buyers. There's A shortage of that, and B, I'd say somewhat of a premium on those residences as well.
You're an investment representative. Your wife has a part-time teaching job with a family planning clinic.
Yes.
What do you find your biggest challenges are living more or less at the Midwest median in DeWitt, Iowa?
Oh, challenges for us, basically with the medical history that we've gone through with our daughter is that we have to go back a little ways, is that it made it difficult for my wife to do her freelance work. She was a writer. And then this opportunity came to her to be this teacher, and she loves this. So that afforded us a little more income right there, a little steadier income anyway. But those medical bills we incurred set us back pretty significantly. And it's nothing that, you know, we don't lose any sleep over it because we know that, you know, we've got somewhat of a handle on that.
But did they set you back in a way that left you saddled with debt or just cut into your income as you went along?
It gave us a pretty significant amount of short-term debt.
But you're a prominent figure in the local community. You just finished a term as president of DeWitt's Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
Do you feel, Mr. Morrell, that you're living the American middle-class life?
I guess I would agree with that. And I guess until this point, I've never really thought of myself as that way. How we look at ourselves is, you know, are we in a situation where our quality of life is good? And the answer to that is yes. And are we able to live a peaceful and happy life? And the answer to that is yes. That's why we live in this community.
And overall, is the American economy working for you?
For me, it most certainly is, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the reasons for my optimism in this area. You know, if you take it back a year ago now and even 3 years ago now, not only was, let's take a year ago now when we were talking about, you know, being on the doorstep of recession with the economy, that was twofold around here because we're a rural community here, and the farmers were getting hit pretty hard. And that's a pretty large base of my customers, and I could see, you know, just in my book of business, the business that I do, that the disposable dollars were not there at that point in time.
You feel it coming back now?
What's that?
You feel it coming back now?
I feel it coming back very good right now, and all you have to do is look at the price of corn and soybeans these days.
And that tells the story. Marty Morrell, thank you so much for sharing and joining with us tonight. Marty Morrell in DeWitt, Iowa. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's see if we can get to them. Alan is on the line. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Good evening. Basically, my point follows up with I'll paint the picture of two local families here in western Pennsylvania.
Okay.
One now in Erie and one in Pittsburgh. And to follow up the last speaker's point, they live peaceful, happy lives. But here's a picture of people living at the edge or at the fringe of middle class. They make 30, the one family does, the other one makes probably closer to 50,000. But if any one thing went wrong, they would be roughly pressed to try and keep sustaining their any kind of lifestyle. Both of my friends' families, we all went to college together. mm-hmm. all six of us.
Okay.
Each of us and our spouses. And but they're my one friend's a respiratory therapist. They had to move three times before he could find a job to sustain him. And then when they found a better job for him, his wife couldn't find work that would pay enough to pay the child care.
So at that level of income, they feel very vulnerable to shifts in the economy and the job market.
Exactly, exactly. The good news for them is he's the respiratory therapist, which at least at this point in medical needs is fairly stable.
So that's holding up. Ellen, thank you for your call. I want to put that to Jared Bernstein. Jared, what about this issue of when a family living at the median gets hit by something unexpected? What happens? Do families tumble down into something near poverty, or how vulnerable are families at that level?
Well, I think they're much more vulnerable than families with higher incomes and more savings. And I think savings is one of the keys here. Because housing costs have increased over time, and many of these families are using up all of their earnings to pay for their health care, their child care, and their basic consumption needs, mm-hmm. they're typically able to put away very little. When we recently did a study on the wealth of middle-income families, we found that many of these families were 2 to 3 months away from using up their savings completely. So I think for me, and this is not some sort of official definition, but for me, one good working definition of middle class is the extent to which an incident of the type that the caller was referring to mm-hmm. could knock you off your economic perch. For wealthier families, they can sustain those kinds of economic shocks and keep going pretty handily.
Jared, let's try and get one more call in here. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. My point is this. Compared to the 1950s and 70s,
okay.
People are expecting far too much. It is entirely possible to live on one income in a 1950s middle-class style if you forgo all the inventions since then.
And if you can remember what a 1950s lifestyle was.
Well, black and white TV, no cable, never fly anywhere, do not even think about vacations outside the country, very basic phone service with hardly ever long-distance calls, and most importantly, 1950s healthcare.
Mark, we got it, and our time is running down, but thank you for your call. Elizabeth Weinstein, how about it? How close, then, is the American middle-class life today to what we now see as the American dream?
It's close. I think the American dream, if you talk to somebody from who's coming into this country, you know, car, house, and a yard, something, and relative stability. And I think it's close. A lot of the people we talk to have that, even despite the fact that, again, they're living close to having a bad time of it.
Jared Bernstein, let me put the same question to you just briefly. How close, then, is the American median household income life to the American dream?
I think I disagree with Elizabeth. I think it's pretty close for people like Marty and a lot less close for people like Erica. Sure, she's definitely plugging away in a heroic way, but she's got some severe constraints right there with some of the healthcare problems she faces. So I think the American dream would really represent a family considerably more secure than that at the median.
Jared, Elizabeth, our time is running down. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Jared Bernstein is senior economist and at the Economic Policy Institute and author of the forthcoming The State of Working America. Thanks for being with us, Jared.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Weinstein, it's been great having you, and congratulations on good work. Elizabeth Weinstein is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. Coming up, the Dear Abby for the Big House. This is On Point. Since the corporate scandals of Enron, Tyco, and WorldCom, David Novak has been a very busy man. The author of Downtime, A Guide to Federal Incarceration, Novak spent a year in prison for mail fraud in 1996. Today, he counseled CEOs, CFOs, and other white-collar executives facing jail time on the truths, the myths, the do's and don'ts of life in the big house. In this radio diary, he shares some of his advice.
The most common questions I get from my white-collar clients generally have to do with material things and communication. White-collar offenders want to know and are often under the misconception about property. Are they allowed to bring in laptop computers? The answer being no. Will they have access to the Internet? No. Are there conjugal visits? No. Will they be allowed to play tennis or golf? No. Will they be allowed furloughs to attend children's weddings or family events? And for the most part, the answer is no to that as well. On the more practical side, people are always very, very concerned with their physical well-being. Do they risk a physical or sexual assault when they go to prison? And I'm pleased to tell you that the answer is no to that as well. The most prevalent pieces of advice that I give to my clients are, first and foremost, accept responsibility and stop fighting. Your choices and your choices alone led you to be in this situation. Second is to recognize that as difficult as this situation may be, it is temporary, and it's important to, as soon as possible, begin laying the groundwork for the remainder of your life. Third piece of advice is to remember that although you're incarcerated, your loved ones and your family members are not. To expect them to put their life on hold is both selfish and unproductive and something that you should really resist doing. Some of the more specific pieces of advice are to remember that before anything else, you are a criminal. It's very, very common for white-collar offenders to enter a prison and identify much more closely with their jailers than their fellow inmates. Obviously, this is a good way to get yourself ostracized by the inmate community. I also inform people the importance, actually, the cherished value of small personal mementos and personal space within prison. It is an absolute breach of protocol in prison to touch anything that belongs to anybody else. Even if somebody was to drop something on the floor in front of you, it's incredibly inappropriate to handle it in any way, even if it's to pick it up and hand it to them. And many people are very physically demonstrative when they speak. Although you and I may be speaking and during the course of a conversation I would put my hand on your shoulder, doing anything like that in prison would be incredibly inappropriate and is frowned upon. In the past 6 months, I have seen a tremendous increase in contact, not only from defendants, but also from attorneys. Not to speak poorly of attorneys who do their job very well, but are simply incapable of addressing the post-sentencing issues that I deal with. I have actually received some positive feedback from people who are just now beginning sentences of incarceration, thanking me not only for preparing them, but for preparing their families for the reality of what they face. I think the biggest thing that most of these people have to deal with is the unknown. And by shedding a light on those unknown areas, I think quite a few people have benefited. And quite frankly, I anticipate this volume of business to continue to grow over the next year.
David Novak is a consultant on incarceration in federal prison and author of Downtime, A Guide to Federal Incarceration. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by